Any other thoughts or questions that you'd like to bring up? Yes, Carla?
Are you equating excellence with perfection? I've heard different definitions.
Oh, you can define it. You can define it almost any way you want. I'm not equating them. There is a difference. Doing things, nobody can do things to perfection, first of all. But excellence, I would define very broadly, and I would say it, doing the job to the level at which it ought to be done. You know, you've worked for me, Carla, and you know that I don't particularly want letters, you know, carbons, for instance, corrected. And I would rather have, and I know this goes counter to some things, but I would rather have certain things gotten out faster than to make sure they're absolutely perfect, some things. But then there are certain things that I want to be just right.
You're doing it to the best of your ability, or what's required
of that? Both. See, sometimes what's required may be beyond your ability. And if I'm going to do woodwork, we're in trouble. You know, I mean, there's just no way I can do it well. You know, if for one thing, I'd probably end up committing suicide after a while. I can't just get frustrated. But see, to your ability, but also what is required. You may have the ability to do it just incredibly perfect. But what's not needed is speed. And to get it done fast. Do you see what I mean? Now, there are other aspects of that. But that's at least one thought on it. Okay, some other thoughts or just questions on the work that came up just as I shared. Yes?
How can we help influence others to work hard, just the basic principles, to work hard, not to be lazy?
Okay, that comes into the issue of motivation. And it's a difference as to whether a person is a Christian or not. There are some things that are common to both Christian and non-Christians in the area of motivation. But with a Christian, one thing that you have is the Word of God. And help them see what it is. When people don't work hard, there's usually a reason why they don't. It has to do sometimes with their family background. It has to do with they don't enjoy it, or there's some attitude issues that need to be dealt with. In a secular context, your ultimate clout is the security of their job. That's the ultimate clout. And I believe in an ultimate clout, incidentally, because we are human. We're sinful beings. And I think we always need to have, particularly in a secular context, that kind of a situation. But the major motivation is, number one, people usually need to see why they're doing what they're doing, where it fits. Also, people need to have a belief that they are contributing to something, that there's a reason for doing it. And there's a whole series of things that relate to motivating someone else. There's negative motivation, and there's positive motivation, and we do want to use the positive one to the greatest extent possible, but the negative one always ought to be known to be there. Fear is not bad in some ways. I'm talking about a secular context now to a large extent. Yeah, Carl?
You mentioned in your book that Christians have a bad reputation in the secular world, and I've seen it myself. Why do you think that is?
Well, their reputation is worse if there are other Christians around, but simply because they in their relationships. But I think it's because their value system is different. That's one issue. Now, that's good that their value system is different, but where it comes into problem is saying this doesn't really count. You know, what really counts is this, this, and this. And what it does, it affects their performance on their job. And the other thing is that sometimes they don't put in the effort to get ahead, to be develop. They won't take the time that it requires to be competent in their work, which takes more than work time. For instance, there have been times around, and one of the projects I will outline to you is, what do you think about the concept that one ought to just get a 40-hour week job pumping gas and then really get on with what's important in life? You know, what does that philosophy communicate, and is it biblical? And the fact is that you won't be respected and won't have a witness unless in the context of one's work you earn that respect. And I wouldn't say that all Christians, I've seen some Christians, I've seen many non-Christians who are not respected, but we all seem to expect more out of a believer in terms of their attitudes. So, that's an incomplete answer, but it's a start on it anyhow. Yes?
one is kind of a different situation because we're all living together and all, but in another job, if I were a boss, or when I have a boss over me, I have a different way that I relate with them and the coworkers, talking about relating to authority. And
yes. Yeah, in a secular job, it's unlikely that you're going to have a strong, close personal relationship with some of your supervisors. For one thing, you live all over town. All relationships, all social relationships are selective. And we often tend to segment parts of our life, and then you select certain relationships that you pursue. And you will often work in context where there are not extremely close personal relationships with those for whom you work, or you with those who work for you. And I don't think we should be under the burden that we must always develop a deep friendship with those with whom we work. I don't think we can handle it. Now, I think some of them you should.
So it's not necessarily wrong to initiate, but sometimes could it be wrong?
Well, no, it's fine to initiate it. It's fine to initiate the relationships, but it's selective. Now, that there's a level of relationship that all ought to be there, an amiable, good working environment where you're friends and you chat. You may even go to a social function together, but it may not go a lot beyond that. And I've had many, many, many relationships that have been that and are that today. And I just wait until God starts to bring one to the surface a bit more where something may develop more deeply with a particular individual. We had the people that were with us for the last 2 days I hadn't seen for 20 years. And we went to school together. I had him in a Bible study, and I mean, we were in the Air Force together, but just through the years, you know, things have developed in the way of communication, and if we were near one another, our friendship would develop a good bit more. But they live in Massachusetts, so okay. Let's take a break. Let's take a 10-minute break, and the thought is in the next session of going into the issue of how to handle stress and pressure, which is a key contact, key issue in the side of work. The third session would be to work on this area of ambition and ability. That would take us to lunch. Then I thought the first session after lunch, which we're all a little kind of down, is to spend some time just with a question and answer session, both with what you have given me and otherwise. Then the next two sessions are very open. One possibility is to do something on the issue of vocational Christian work, concept of vocational Christian work. Another possibility is I can do something on ethics and morality and try and apply some of it in the business situation, the work situation. Or we could just have another pretty good-sized question and answer time. And so as we go through the morning, does this stress, would that meet some good needs as far as you're concerned? Okay, let's do the stress. And then anybody would like to help me, give me some direction for later on, because I can either shorten or extend this question and answer type of thing. And I've got more material than what we could do for 3 days. So the fact is I could preach to you the whole day. So let's take a break now. And so then I says, Colorado, you know, I've got to have a lined coat. So I had my shirt and my tie and a sweater and a jacket and a lined overcoat. And I was really ready for Colorado. And so I came to the airport. Mary dropped me off. She just slows down to 10 miles an hour these days and rolls me out the door. And I went in, and at Seattle, I checked all my stuff, a little hanger case and my suitcase. So I just had my briefcase, and I went down to a little subway that goes out to one of the satellite facilities in Seattle. And as I was waiting for the subway, I wanted to get something out of my briefcase, and it was that big one over there. And so I squatted down like this, and all of a sudden I felt this horrible breeze. And I realized my pants had just ripped about 3 inches or 4 inches down the back. And I thought, oh, no. I've checked my stuff. A pastor is meeting me in Denver to go meet with a group of businessmen. What do I do? And I thought, I got it. I ran up. I don't leave too much time before flights, but I said, I'll go up and get one of these little sewing kits. And as soon as I get on the airplane, I'll go into the restroom and I'll sew my pants up. But that's simple. Now, so I had this all planned, and that relieved the stress just a little bit. The physical stress had already happened. My pants ripped. Now the emotional stress starts. So I got on the airplane, and of course I couldn't take off my overcoat because, you know, you reach out, you know, just I had to leave my overcoat on. So I just said, well, I'll do this, and that looked a little funny. And I said, as soon as he takes off, you know, and turns off the seatbelt sign, I'll just head back there. Well, it was bumpy. So the seatbelt sign said, and there I sit, sweater, shirt, coat, lined overcoat, the whole bit, and just starting to drench. And on for over half an hour, bouncing out. And finally, the seatbelt sign goes off, and I jumped up, and the gals beat me to it, hitting the aisles with the carts, you know, so I couldn't get through. And so I said, well, I'll eat lunch first. So I sat back down with this horrible thing. And finally, after this whole business, they finally finished. Here I am an hour into the flight. And so as soon as I could get through, I went back. And, you know, here I have overcoat and all this stuff. And so I say, now what? I've never sewn up a pair of pants in my life. As a matter of fact, I don't know how to sew. A button, yes, but nothing else. So I take my pants off, and I'm in there trying to figure, and I wonder what, you know, and I kept going like this, and it took me a little while, and pretty soon, blam, 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 on the door comes. Someone thought that I'd been in there just a bit too long, and I said, don't worry, I'll be out in just a minute. And so I finally got it done, very proud, came up, sat down. Guy met me in Denver, and then we just walked down these stairs. He drove me down to Colorado Springs, and so I'm carrying my stuff in. He says, good night, your pants are ripped. Question, when did they rip again? Now I thought, what an example. It was such a hilarious deal, I had to go immediately to the phone and call Mary and tell what happened. Because it just became a comedy of errors as time went on through the day. But you know, little things like that cause stress. And stress comes from a lot of different places. They come from physical things, they come from emotional things, they come from just good hard work, they come from good things, good events. You know, we had a wedding here recently. Well, there's stress to a wedding. And so all of us see the effects of stress in our lives. And the effects are rather obvious many times. We get headaches, we get anxiety, we become depressed, we get tired. We get just physically ill in other ways. And then what the problem is we feel guilt. Because you see, intellectually, we know that as Christians, we should not be easily stressed out like that. And we ought to be able to handle all of these things. But then we're torn because we start churning inside because we say, hey, I shouldn't feel this way. But then we are torn by the disparity between our mind and our will, between our feelings and our theology. Have you ever had that problem? You say, I shouldn't feel this way, but I do feel this way. I shouldn't be depressed. Well, I am depressed. And so I have come to the conclusion that no one escapes stress. It's just simply a constant of life. And you know, even lack of pressure is stress. A person can only handle so many weeks of vacation where you really have nothing to do. Now, maybe you'd love to try it sometime. But believe me, it'll come to pieces for you after a while. Let's turn to Philippians chapter 4. Philippians chapter 4, beginning at verse 4. Okay. It says, rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I say rejoice. Let your forbearing spirit be known to all men. The Lord is near, but in everything by prayer and supplication, or be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all comprehension, shall guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. Those are good words. You know, I've memorized them, and you've probably memorized them. You repeat them to yourself and say, be anxious for nothing. But you said, but I still am anxious. He said, well, now if I just pray about it, it'll be okay. And the more you pray about it, the more stressful you get. And the reality of this verse is very difficult to put into practice. I don't know whether you found that, but I have. But yet, there is something here that we need to consider. Verses 8 through 13 are so key. And what I'd like to do is just review these slightly, and then I'll go into some other issues, and you'll have to think back to these verses, because I'm not going down through a verse-by-verse teaching on the issue of stress. Because some of the issues of stress are not essentially biblical things. They're just practical issues. Now, the Bible speaks to many practical issues, but I'm not going to try to prove every point with a passage of Scripture. I think there are many that we could. But let's look at beginning at verse 8. Finally, brethren, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is of good repute, if there is any excellence and if there is anything worthy of praise, let your mind dwell on these things. And that is a key phrase for that verse. Let your mind dwell. A great deal of stress is how we allow our mind to function. Now, that's not easy to control what you think about, but it is possible. It really is. Then verse 9 says, the things you have learned and received and heard and seen in me, practice these things, and the God of peace shall be with you. But I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now at last you have revived your concern for me. And Paul says, indeed, you were concerned before, but you lacked opportunity. Now verses 11 and 12 are key to our thinking. Not that I speak from want, for I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. I know how to get along with humble means, and I also know how to live in prosperity. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of being filled and going hungry, both of having abundance and suffering need. Now, without looking at your Bible, what is the next verse? I can do all things through Christ, which strengthens me. And we kind of say it as it's just sort of a saying, you know, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. But there's a condition. And the condition is verses 11 and 12. See, Paul says that in the context of verses 11 and 12, where he has said, you know, I have learned to be content. He doesn't say I just automatically knew how to be content. But he said I learned to be content. That was a process. And he said, I learned to be content in every circumstance, regardless. Now, I think that is perhaps the key thing that we as Christians need to learn, is how to be satisfied in any circumstance in which we will find ourselves. In fact, when we view circumstances, how do you respond? God, why did you put me here? We normally, you see, want to blame somebody for whatever circumstance we're in. And we can't, it's hard to come to grips with the fact that God has placed us there. All the difficulty, the problems, some family issues, conflicts, hard work, long work, etc. The fact is that circumstances are things that God has ordained, and Paul seemed to grasp that. He said, I've learned to be content. Now, does he say there, I like it? No. Does he say, I just revel in this circumstance? You know, in beatings and imprisonments and scourgings, lost in the deep. He didn't say he liked it. He says, left for dead, having been stoned. He didn't say any time he liked that. But he just simply said, I have learned to be content. Contentment and enjoyment are different concepts. And so the key is learning to be content. Now, being content is an incredible stress reliever. But then he goes on and says, now let me give you some specific examples. He said, I've learned how to get along with humble means, and I also know how to live in prosperity. In any and every circumstance, I have what? Learned. And learned what? What does he call it, at least in the New American Standard? It says a secret. Okay, there's a secret, he says. I've learned the secret. I've learned the key of being filled and going hungry, having abundance and suffering need. So he says, I've learned that I can't have everything. And it's been a process. And he says, now how have I learned that? He says, I can do all things through Christ, which strengthens me. But I don't believe he could have said that had he not been willing to say that, God, I am willing to live in any circumstance that you put me. And I'm willing to live in this difficult time of my life. And so with that as a background, I'd like to go into some other, just some other thoughts that in this session on stress. First of all, it says, rejoice, don't be anxious, peace of God. You know, we know it, but where is it? And here is the thing, and I wrote this down in the notes because I wanted you to see it. I said, we see others who live stress-filled lives, and it rolls off their backs like rain off a duck. And you encounter one-fourth of the stress and collapse, and it almost says it isn't fair. Why can one person take such incredible stress, and I just run into a little deal and practically faint? Well, let me remind you, they may not escape. Stress tends to be cumulative. And secondly, to know that people have different capacities for stress. And we'll talk about that as we proceed. Okay, let's talk about the major issues regarding stress. Oh, I love this little cartoon. I forgot to put it on here. This is the snake that's stretching from point to point, and I think that's really true. Sometimes we overextend ourselves. But let's go into the major causes of stress. These are not the only ones. I'm just saying they're major causes. And the first major cause of stress is the issue of conflict. Let me get my notes organized here. I've got two sets of notes. Now, conflict puts me under stress more than anything else. I don't know about you. Now, I will say that there's a difference, though, between men and women in this issue. Women who are in conflict, particularly in the workforce, they don't even want to talk to one another or to the person that they're in conflict with. They would rather stay home and not even come to work than face it. Men seem to be more crass. They seem to be more, they just kind of bull on through it, even if you're in conflict. I've seen it time and time again. It just seems to be a characteristic of men and of women. Women tolerate conflict in the workplace far less than men do. Women want the conflict resolved. Men don't care, in general. Now, some do. Some are very sensitive to it. But most men let it build up until it explodes. And that's when they usually leave the job. Or that they have to move out from the context of that particular department. But women tend to handle it quicker. They'll let it explode too at times. But women have a less tolerance, I believe, of it. Now, I believe that God wants us to be able to survive conflict. But we have to be able to enter conflict and to be able to do it without exhibiting great deals of stress in our life. And that is not easy. Now, the second thing I believe that is very important in the area of stress is blocked goals. Larry Crabb in his seminar helped me a great deal last January when he differentiated between desires and goals. He said a desire is something that you want to see happen. I want to get along with so-and-so. I want to have a promotion in my job. Whereas a goal, see, a desire is something you can't make sure happens. You cannot make someone else like you. Whereas a goal is that over which you have control. I want to finish this project today. In a sense, you have control over that. Now, there may be interruptions, but you could work overtime. You could somehow meet that goal. Or a goal is something that you can do and have control over. Now, he says that one of the major issues in conflict is the issue of blocked goals. Some of you submitted to me questions saying, what do you do about interruptions? You know, do you put people first or the task first? Well, what is happening here is you have a goal to finish a particular piece of work. Someone else comes along, sometimes it's your boss, and diverts you from that work or takes your time and you start getting uptight, right? Okay, the reason is you have a blocked goal. See, you want to get something done, and somebody else is blocking it. Now, that's a fairly obvious one. But what if you want to have a certain kind of relationship with somebody, and it doesn't come about? That goal is blocked. I would say that an extreme amount of conflict is caused by blocked goals. We want to do something. Something prevents me from doing that, either my own abilities, somebody else's control of my life, the way the work is structured, or a relationship. Something blocks it, and therefore I get frustrated and angry and uptight inside. So the question is, what do you do? Well, one thing, you can change your goal. If you understand that that should be a desire instead of a goal, then that will help put that barrier of the goal down and will relieve some of the stress. Particularly in friendships and relationships. You can't make someone else be your friend. And so you only can have it as a desire, not as a goal. Now, I believe a major cause of stress is children. Now, I realize that many of you are not married, but if you, it is children. They will cause problems. And another is fear. Fear of the future, fear of finances, fear of tragedy. And everybody has fear. There's not one person in this room, including myself, who does not have fears inside. All you have to do is to get me in the right environment and I will be fearful. Or a certain series of events happening and I will be fearful. You know, I don't think there's any one of us that have not wakened in the middle of the night or had a nightmare on some issue of fear. I have a recurring dream. Any of you interpreters of dreams? I had it the night before I spoke to pastor's conference last Friday. And it's that I got up to speak and I was in my pajamas. Or I was improperly dressed. You know, that one was pajamas. But to get somewhere, well, you know, there's a fear. You know, have I forgotten this or am I okay? And I'm sure, and I probably goes back to 24 years ago in my analysis where I left Cape Canaveral and I went out on a speaking assignment down to Miami for the Air Force. And I got there and it was late at night and I was to speak to some public function, some service club in the morning in the uniform, got into the motel at 10 o'clock at night and realized I did not have my uniform shirt. What do I do? I mean, you know, they just don't, and it's late at night. Well, I did find an old Army service store or something, and I found something that worked, and it was such a pain, and I'll bet that's where that dream comes from, because it's a fear. But all of us have little things over our lives that are fears. And they're not all wrong. We're human people. And we just have to realize them. But they put stress on us. I think all of us fear change. Change puts stress on everybody. You move, you get a different job, you get married, there's a death of a loved one. There are just all kinds of things that put us under stress in terms of change. Most people simply don't want to change. And most people would rather have things go as they are. We're going through a tremendous change in the United States right now in the Navigators. Well, there are many people who are going to be fearful. What's going to happen? What will my job be? Who will I report to? What will I do? How will this new boss think about me? What's going to happen a year from now? What will happen? What am I going to do when I finish the LDI? And you go on, and all of that is change that is going to come into our lives. And it causes a stress. And finally, I want to note sin and disobedience. When we're sinning, I believe God puts stress in. God is going to bring some things to pass in our lives. Now, what are some other things that put you under stress? What are some things that put you under stress? There are many more than this. I've just listed these as major categories that cause stress. What are some things that put you under stress? Yeah, right?
One thing that comes to my mind was one of my questions. Sometimes I'm not sure if I'm mismanaging the workload I have or is the workload too large for one individual?
Okay, yeah, so...
I feel like I'm drowning in work.
Right. Okay, then, and there's always more work to do than you can accomplish, isn't that right? I've never been in a place in my life where that wasn't the case. And the issue of life normally is that we have to pick what we do out of our workload. And once you've selected it, you just have to believe that God led you. You will make some mistakes in that process. And there were some other things about how to get things done in the questions, and I'd like to talk about it. I'm not doing a session on time management during our time here, but I do have some things that I personally practice on getting things done and selecting things, Rich. So, but that does put you under stress, and that's an important issue. And most of us face that. I've only had one job in my life where I was just didn't have much to do, and it was the worst experience I've ever had. You know, you just feel bored in that regard. Not because you did, it was because you had nothing to do, or very little. It was just for a few months. Yes?
What about expectations that are put on you?
Okay, very good. That's superb. There are two kinds of expectations, aren't there? Yours and someone else's. And they don't often come together. Yeah, your expectations put you under stress. See, my expectations of my children put them under stress. My expectations of Mary put under stress. Normally in the family, they're always higher because you're not as subtle about the way you communicate your expectations. And you sort of take off the gloves, you know, and go after it. But that's really good, expectations. There was... Julie?
Indecision.
Ah, that gets me sometimes. I become indecisive on some of the smallest issues sometimes. And it frustrates me. Why, you know, I can make big decisions. Why can't I make these? But you're right. Just indecision. And that's where a step of faith comes. You just have to make a decision sometimes. Yeah.
Assuming a negative response from an individual, it goes into conflict and fear. But
right.
Waking up in the middle of the night, assuming the situation is going to turn out for the worse.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's right. You know, if you expect the worst, you'll be surprised at anything.
Yeah.
Everything will be good. It's kind of like eat a frog, you know, and it'll nothing worse can happen to you the rest of the day. That's right. You had a...
Yes. Responsibility.
Oh, yeah. Okay, responsibility. Especially if it's more than what you've had before and... Yeah, put you under pressure and stress. Just plain hard work and responsibility does. My dad, for instance, he had an opportunity one time, I think, to be the dispatcher at this freight company that he worked for. He didn't want it. He said, why would I want all that responsibility? And, you know, to me, who's a responsibility seeker, that was an anomaly, see, to even think about that. See, some people seek responsibility, others don't. Now, it doesn't mean it's good or bad. It's just somewhat the way you're put together. He said, I don't want all that responsibility. Man, they hassle him all the time. And I think he was a very wise person. He understood what his personal limitations were and said, why should I take under all that hassle? And so he made a good decision. I've seen others who take responsibility that they shouldn't, which is something to talk about a little bit. Okay, let's talk for. Let's go to our next section here, and I'd like to talk about what does stress do in us. Talk about the short-term effects of stress. Okay, on the short term, there are certain things that stress does to us, and on the long term, there are certain things that stress does to us. First of all, in the short term, I believe anger is an issue. Well, there are two kinds of anger. There's anger outwardly and anger inwardly. Now, probably most people who have worked with me have never seen me angry. In fact, my family has rarely ever seen me angry because I don't. That's just not part of me to any great extent externally. In fact, when I've gotten angry in the home, it's such a surprise that they don't quite know how to handle it. But that doesn't mean I don't get angry inside. See, some people bottle it up, and some people express it. Now, I try and deal with my anger. But anger is a short fuse, both internally and externally. Proverbs 15, 1 and 2 says that a soft answer turns away wrath, but grievous words stir up anger. The tongue of the wise uses knowledge aright, but the mouth of fools pours forth foolishness. Someone has said that temper is what gets most of us into trouble, and pride is what keeps us there. And I think that's a good quote. James 1:19, by the way, is another reference in the area of anger. So that's a sign. If you find yourself getting angry, it's generally a sign of stress. Now, some people, and I want to distinguish this, there are some people who have to deal with an angry spirit that is different than dealing with anger. In other words, the tenor of your life could be anger. And there are people who've grown up that way, and it's a deep spiritual issue to be dealt with, being an angry person in just an overlay of one's life. And that's an issue of sin and an issue of character that has to be dealt with. Now, that's not what I'm talking about here. What I'm talking about is you get under stress and you start to get what we call a short fuse. You'll have to pardon me, those of you folk, Martin, and I use some... What do you call those idioms? Yeah, the idioms, a short fuse. And by the time you finish your time in the United States, you'll have lots of idioms. So a short fuse, doesn't that come from a firecracker or a piece of dynamite that has a very short fuse? You light it and you run real quickly and it explodes. See? So that's what it is, short fuse. Now, the second is a critical spirit. Now, I believe that this is something that we, all of us, have to deal with. There is not one of us in this room that cannot look at something that's going on here today and find something to criticize. Say, I walk in here today and I say, gee, this doesn't look like it's a good arrangement, maybe. I immediately look for something that might be wrong. And it's just a problem that we just have to deal with. But what you'll find is that under stress, this is exaggerated. That everything, you start finding that everything someone else does just gets you ticked off a little bit. It just gets you to be more critical of what they're doing. And I think we need to be very, very careful that we don't allow a critical spirit to overcome us. Now, what is the difference between a critical spirit and just criticism? I was on a trip recently, and I really had to deal with this in a particular situation. Because and it made me think about it. It really worked out well, this last trip that Lauren and I went on. He got to do all the blessing, and I got all the problems. You know, people who had any problem or something, they come to me, and there were some issues that were some real criticisms. Well, now, some of the criticism was just of some aspect of it was a financial issue, and that's always rather emotional. So I got to thinking, now, what's the difference? When does criticism that is good end, and when does a critical spirit begin? Now, here is just an idea that I'd like to share with you. Let me turn to Proverbs 21, 1 and 2. I think this is the verse. Yeah. Proverbs 21, 1 and 2, it says, the king's heart is like the channels of water in the hands of the Lord. He turns it wherever he wishes. Every man's way is right in his own eyes, but the Lord weighs the hearts. You see, when we see something that we want to criticize, obviously I saw it, it's right. See, every man's way is right in his own eyes. And everybody will have different opinions. You get three people together and you're going to have a conflict of some sort as to how to do some particular task. So, but here is what I think on just criticism, that it's shared and the result is left to God. Whereas a critical spirit will not rest until the matter is resolved as that individual wants it resolved. Do you see the difference? You know, it's kind of like, you know, Chinese water torture, drip, 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 you know, just constantly pushing on a particular item. Rather than just sharing it openly and saying, now here's a problem I see and here's what I think about it and I really don't think this is right. I think we could do it better in this way. But you know, it's not my direct responsibility. I just want to share that need. And and then leave it. Warren Myers is very faithful in this. When I was chairman of the U.S. Finance Committee, just about every time Warren came to the United States, as we were wrestling with the issue of what is proper compensation, proper salary, etc., equity, and so forth, Warren would come, and he would sit down, and he would have his Bible, and he would share with me the details of how he was thinking, and said, I'd just like to give you this input. And once he'd given it to me, and not all of it that I agreed with, and in fact, we didn't always apply it in the committee that I was working in. But Warren never brought it up again. He said, well, I just want to share it. Here's what I'm thinking, and just for input to you. And he just left it like that. See, that is criticism. We are responsible for just criticism. Now, people have different abilities in criticizing. Some people cannot criticize without antagonizing. And you remember the quote that I mentioned a little bit ago, you cannot persuade and antagonize at the same time. So there is a real art to giving criticism. As I was going home last night from the Bible study, I led the study, and there were six of us in the car, and one of the wives gave me a good suggestion on the study. And she did it in a very gracious way on how we could make it more effective next time. And another person said something, well, boy, I don't know, I didn't get into that study at all, and it sure better get better next time, you know, into the study itself, not the discussion we had. And they're all my friends, you know, but there's a difference. Some people always share things with an edge, kind of a rusty edge. You know, and other people share things skillfully, like a surgeon's knife, you know, that it gives healing when it operates. By the way, just another thought. I just looked at my notes here. Some people can only see what is wrong, and they never can see what is right. Isn't it frustrating sometimes to work all day long and a person only finds out one thing that was wrong when you did about 100 things that were right? It can get to you after a bit, put you under a lot of stress. And another thing that I believe stress evokes in us on the short term is anxiety and worry. The fact is that when you're under stress, you tend to worry more. There's a quote here that I have on worry. It says, worry is often nothing more than a refusal to face unpleasant facts, and the result can be paralysis and an inability to come up with solutions. And someone else has said that 90% of what you worry about never comes to pass. But I say it's the 10% that gets to you sometimes. Proverbs 12:25 is a good verse to jot down. And another short-term effect is tears. Now, that doesn't happen to men too often, but it does. Sometimes privately. Some people, the tears don't actually come, but you know they're there. And I think with women often, who will tend to allow that emotion to show more, that the tears will be there. But often it's a short-term thing. Now, all I'm saying is that these are short-term effects of stress. Now, if you look at Psalm 42, I jotted that down. I'm not going to go through all of Psalm 42, but I believe David is experiencing the effects of stress in his life. Down in verse 5, he says, why are you in despair, O my soul, and why have you become disturbed within me? And then down in 6, he says, oh my God, my soul is in despair within me. And then later on, he talks about his life, you know, as being broken apart. And, down in verse 10, is a shattering of my bones, my adversaries revile me. Well, they say to me all day long, where is your God? Why are you in despair, O my soul? Why have you become disturbed within me? And then he always goes on and says, hope in God, for my hope is in him. But if you look through Psalm 42 and some other psalms, you'll find that David was a man who despaired a good bit. He may well have been a melancholic. We don't really know. Now let's talk about some long-term effects of stress, because I think stress, on the short term, you can get those signs. But on the long term, it's a little different. On the long term, what we'll find, there will be three primary effects. One is physical. You do become ill from stress. There's not one of us in this room who hasn't had an upset stomach, I'll bet, because of stress. You know, things happen to us physically. And there are probably ailments that we have now that are from a long time of stress, and they're physical illnesses that we will not get rid of. There are various kinds of things that happen to us, and our body alters, and we may not be able to get rid of it, even though we've taken care of the stress. For instance, stress, most people know that, in general, ulcers come from stress, don't they? You know, in the way you respond to stress. And by the way, I forgot to emphasize that back there. The problem is usually not stress, per se, but our response to stress. How we respond to stress is the key, and I wrote that down on the first page. But there are also emotional effects of stress. When we've undergone significant things in our lives emotionally, we will always be tender in that area again. You know, I've gone through a period of depression in 1977. It was very, very hard. I'm not a person who gets depressed. But I've got memories of that, and I don't particularly want to go through it again. And personally, I just wore myself out physically, and it had the emotional effects of stress. Mary can tell you that in 1965, she underwent such stress that she ended up with mononucleosis at an age when she wasn't supposed to have it, and they didn't think she had, but that's what it turned out to be. And it has lasted. There are certain effects of that stress period that she can feel today physically. She's got a warning that automatically comes. She'll start, when we start running the system so heavily in our schedule and so forth, she'll start getting chest pains. It has nothing to do with heart, but just chest pains. And it's an immediate signal that we're going too hard. Well, it's a blessing, but it also is an effect of some things that happened physically a number of years before, to be precise, 19 years ago. And there are also spiritual effects of stress. The emotional are, of course, that we get discouragement and depression. There are spiritual effects in that our quiet time starts going down, our motivation starts to wane, and we start to feeling great guilt. But you know, there are also some important things related to stress that I believe can help us. For instance, I believe that stress and all that goes with us, it can drive us to the end of ourselves, and some of us need that. For myself, I feel that this experience I had in 1977 was probably one of the most helpful experiences of my life, because it brought me to the end of myself and demonstrated some things to me that I needed to change in the way I lived. And it, of course, drives us to God. It causes us to turn to Him. Psalm 119, verse 67 says, "Before I was afflicted, I went astray, but now have I turned to God." See, many times we don't really turn to God in the way we ought to until some hard times come in our lives. Now, I'd like to go to this next little section on the solution. Oh, by the way, let me stop here for just a moment. And just, do you have any questions or you'd like some clarification on some item? Or just maybe to make a comment? Yeah.
Kevin, I came from Brighton. I here had stress management seminars, and they told us that all the managers should put their employees under stress because it was better for the company.
Well, there's an interesting aspect on that, and I've got a quote that I'd like to read to you if I could do it somewhat. Yeah. A Dr. Marvin has written this. He says, "Stress is really an integral part of life. We set our whole pattern of life by our stress endpoint. If we hit it exactly, we live dynamic, purposeful, useful, and happy lives. If we go over, we break. But if we stay far under, we vegetate." See, none of us want absence of stress. It's like the leg, you know, that's broken and in a cast, and the muscles, what do you call it, atrophy? The muscles atrophy. See, because they're not under stress. We need a certain amount of stress. Now, I don't know the extreme that they meant that statement, that you ought to put your employees under stress. But the fact is that in a work environment, there is stress, and you need to have a sense of goal orientation, and if you want to call that stress, fine. But the kind of stress I'm talking about is that which is internalized to a large extent. So we do want stress. I mean, without stress, in a sense. You know, what would life be? I mean, we just don't live. If we don't have stress, we create it. Have you ever been in a situation where you were just under such pressure and you finally got the whole thing done? It says, boy, now I'll relax. And pretty soon your mind brings up about three other stresses that you didn't even recognize were there. You know, it's just we're people who will put ourselves under stress in some way. But that's a good thought. I'm glad you mentioned that. Okay, any other thoughts or questions? Carla?
Could you give a little bit of different capacities?
Yes, I will. Let me look and see if I've got that a little later in my notes. Yes, Carla, I think I'm going to have it a little later, and let me just bring it into a context a little later, because there is a tremendously different capacity for people in stress. Yes, Evie?
Thinking of a B and C, you might put
mismanaged
stress is what we've been on in the short and long term.
Okay, mismanaged?
Just to distinguish between good and bad stress.
That's a good point. Yeah, that really is a good point. Let me just jot that in here. Yeah, because we do want stress. We really need it to keep us productive, to keep us going. Not all of us are total self-starters. I'm pretty much a self-starter, but even I need goals and deadlines, and I sometimes need them externally applied to me. You know, and they are, you know, from various demands that are on my time. But that stress helps me focus to what really needs to be done. I don't like the stress. You know, nobody likes to be pushed. But I really benefit greatly from it. Was there another comment? I thought I saw another hand a moment ago. Okay, let's go into the solution for a little bit, or at least an attempt at a solution. First of all, I just make a comment to recognize the cost of stress, that it is cumulative over the years. I wish I had a coat hanger here, and I would demonstrate it to you. But if I had a wire coat hanger, we don't need to get one. If I had a wire coat hanger, I think you can all visualize this, that I can bend it so far, and then it'll pop right back, right? Bend it so far, it'll pop back. Okay, then you go to where it actually bends. Then have you ever tried to straighten out a bend in a coat hanger? You know, you never can get rid of that bump. What has happened, engineering-wise, is the material has gone beyond its point of elasticity. That is, it has been stressed so that it actually is unbalanced in its structure. And the atoms and the molecules will not go back together in the same way that they were once there until it's applied a great deal of heat again and reformed. So what it did, it was stressed beyond its point of return. Now that's what we want to worry about. That's what we want to take care on. See, stress can be cumulative, and what we don't want to do is go so far beyond our points that we damage ourselves. And we don't want to waste stress on things that shouldn't, that aren't worthy of it. I mean, there are some stresses you can't change. You know, you are going to die someday. You know, everybody is going to die someday. William Saroyan, I believe his name was, an author. Is that how you pronounce that? Does anybody know? He's a famous author. All you NAB Press people should know that. He was saying on his illness, he was dying, and finally he says, you know, he says, I knew that everybody died, but somehow I thought I'd be an exception. You know, you're all going to have physical problems. There's not one in this room that will not be physically affected someday, and boy, that puts stress on you. It's worse when it happens when you're young, when you start losing your ability for energy, when your body starts to give way in some fashion or another. But it will happen because we are mortal, and it will put us under stress. Now, it's not that. It's not the normal degradation of the human system that I'm talking about. I'm just talking about misuse of our body. I think we need to recognize some of the peculiarities of NAV staff situation. Now, I realize that some of you know, you're not in quite the classic area representative status, but let me make a few comments about being on staff in the field of the navigators. Not so much at admin services here. First of all, I know of no job where I've ever had so much freedom. It is incredible the amount of freedom that a navigator staff person, he decides when he wants to get up, he decides when he's going to have his quiet time, he decides when he's going to do Bible study, he decides what he's going to schedule. I mean, it's a freedom that's almost frightening. Now, this brings me into a little comment that I feel that people who go directly out of school into full-time Christian work will often have some problems. I have observed among the navigators, and this is one of the questions, that's why I'm addressing this now, I have observed among NAV staff that those who have worked in a secular job have a different attitude toward both authority and schedule and goals than people who have not. You get a person who all he has done is kind of come through our NAV Bible studies and systems, never has had a very responsible job, or has gone through seminary where everything is spiritual and theoretical, that he develops an idealistic view of the way life ought to be run and places a Christian organization up against that ideal, and it just isn't there. It just isn't there. Whereas I find that people who have lived in an authority situation and in difficult work circumstances, that they adjust very, very easily to schedules, to goals, to planning, to other things like that. Things that are just normal in life. And so I feel personally that it's best for a person to have a couple years of that before they're full-time.